morning. I'm Judge Mormon. To my right is Judge Lance, and to my left is Judge Scholin. We're here today in the matter of Melvin Aponte versus R. James Nicholson, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 042496. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Robert Chisholm, the appellant, Melvin Aponte. With me is Liz Goldberg, also Lee Counsel, Colby Arden.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes.
Yeah. Counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
About 10 minutes.
You may proceed.
The Federal Circuit decision in Richland is about expenses incurred by an attorney who used a paralegal to perform certain tasks. The attorney in that case sought to recover paralegal costs at a rate higher than the actual cost. Richland held that EJIA does not allow that, and the Federal Circuit denied the appellant's motion recently in April of 2007 for reconsideration. Mr. Aponte is not seeking reimbursement for expenses as in the Richland case. What he's seeking is attorney fees for the legal services performed by one person, attorney Elizabeth Goldberg. Richland is not controlling in Mr. Aponte's case. Attorney Liz Goldberg, like many members of this bar, work on the appellant side as a sole practitioner, and is the attorney who performed all the legal work in this case. As a solo practitioner, she performed all the tasks necessary to the litigation of Mr. Aponte's claim. She does not employ a paralegal, as in the Richland case, nor did she hire one to assist her to help her in this case. In the EJIA application, Ms. Goldberg reduced her billing rate for certain tasks that she performed because billing judgment required it. Those tasks were laid out in the original EJIA application, and in summary, they are the following: a detailed synopsis of the medical records, a review of the record on appeal to be sure that all counter-designated materials were included and nothing was excluded, a review of medical records to determine which private medical records were associated with the claims file at the time of the March 3 medical exam, which was a critical part of her initial brief in this matter, which later led to the JMR. A list of medical records in the file between February 9, 1999 and March 04. The table of authorities, the table of contents. And last but not least, she site checked the entire brief. Those are the tasks which are at issue in this matter in terms of the paralegal service.
She called those paralegal jobs, paralegal tasks. Are those paralegal tasks?
I think they fall in the gray area between attorney tasks and paralegal tasks. I think all those tasks could have been billed at the regular attorney rate. However, in her judgment, she believed that it was appropriate to reduce them because they were in that gray area.
So is there significance to her calling them paralegal tasks?
I don't believe there is significance to labeling them paralegal tasks. I think that was just to reflect a reduction for a lower rate. Clearly, these are tasks that could have been performed by an attorney and billed at the full EJIA rate. However, she found it appropriate in this circumstance to reduce them. As Ms. Goldberg wrote in response,
Chisholm, aren't some of those addressed in precedent that this court has? And the gray area, isn't it, between a paralegal and a secretary on some of those?
I think there are clearly some tasks, and she outlined those in her EJIA response, that she did not bill for at all, that were more administrative tasks. And those were specifically listed in her EJIA response. I think the work that's at issue here, and what I just laid out, is clearly in the gray area between attorney tasks and paralegal tasks. I don't think the court has exactly hit on that issue that I'm aware of, but we did cite to some cases in the response to the January 5th order.
Well, let us presume that they are paralegal tasks for the sake of argument. And then the fact that they were performed by an attorney, how does that make a case for an enhanced rate just because they are performed by an attorney rather than performed by a paralegal if they are indeed paralegal tasks?
If you're going to assume that these were indeed paralegal tasks and they're performed by an attorney, there's clearly case law that says the fact that an attorney does a task or a specific thing doesn't sort of cloak it with the right to a full attorney fee. And
So it's the inability to package that into a cost that should determine that this is a fee, not a cost?
No, I don't. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, to me, this is an all or nothing proposition. Either these are fees for which you can be charged at the appropriate rate, whatever the court deems is reasonable, and we suggest, based on the Lafley matrix, it's $110 per hour. You can't expense something that you didn't incur, so it's either that or zero, it seems to me. It doesn't seem to me that there's an in-between in this situation, as the Secretary seems to be suggesting in their response to January.
How would drafting a table of contents constitute an attorney task?
Well, I think, again, that's something that could be done by an attorney or a paralegal, and as I said, in this case, she decided to bill that at a lesser rate. That one is clearly on the line, it seems to me. However, citation checks are clearly important, and in this case, in reviewing the Secretary's response, they cited to a case called Johnson, from the Fifth Circuit, which was later overturned by the Supreme Court, but that wasn't noted in their pleading. So citation checks clearly is something that can be and should be performed.
How about compiling a table of authorities?
Again, these are tasks that attorneys traditionally have done, but can also be assigned to a paralegal to do as well.
Well, the fact that an attorney can do it doesn't necessarily make it subject to an attorney's fee, even at a reduced rate, does it?
Well, I think
attorneys can type.
Yes.
Attorneys can open mail. Attorneys can file. That doesn't create those as attorney fee candidates, those tasks, does it?
No, those specific tasks, no. Court finds that those are clearly tasks that are not in the nature of attorney work, and the appropriate number would be zero, I would suggest. But the remainder of those tasks, I think, do fall into the nature of attorney services for which they should be compensated.
Is there any circumstance under which a sole practitioner who chooses to do tasks which might be characterized as paralegal work would be entitled to the equivalent of what the expense would be if they contracted that work out?
Yes, I think if I were to hire, what you're suggesting, if I were to hire a paralegal to do the things such as site checking and also to compile the table of authorities, and I build that, and I hired someone to do that, and I could discreetly say that this was $25 an hour, my cost, and clearly under Richland, that would be then reimbursable.
And what if you chose to do that yourself? Could you then expense that at $25 an hour, $35 an hour, whatever?
I think the problem is I'm not charging the client for that as an expense. I'm charging the client for that as a fee under the fee issue. I don't think you can expense something you haven't incurred. All you've incurred is the time and effort that went into it.
Both Richland, the Richland Court, and the Supreme Court in Jenkins talked about the philosophical underpinnings of 1988 and the Aegis statute, and indicated what behavior might occur as the result of the adoption of a particular view with regard to paralegal fees or expenses. It seems to me, and I'd like for you to comment, on whether or not there's an incentive for a sole practitioner to do paralegal work and bill even at a reduced rate for that work when that work could be contracted out to a paralegal at a substantially lesser rate. And how should this court deal with that possibility?
Never knows whether one's going to be successful in any given appeal. For bigger firms, that's easier because they can absorb the cash hit up front. But I don't think there are many solo in this particular case, what the work that was actually performed by Ms. Aponte, I'm sorry, by Ms. Aponte, Mr. Aponte's counsel was, for the most part, paralegal legal work, which could have been performed by an attorney and fully billed at each rate. And I think Richland actually recognized, the Federal Circuit in Richland recognized that. On page 1380, I'm quoting now, if the attorney did the work himself, he would be limited to the 125 per hour, likely far less than his market rate. If he referred the work to a paralegal, he could recover at or near the full rate of paralegals. And I think what the court's implicitly saying there is that an attorney can perform this kind of work and be reimbursed for it. In this case, I'm sorry, in Richland, the attorney elected to use a paralegal for most of those tasks.
Mr. Chisholm, let me address the problem that I see and something that bothers me a great deal. Is on December 19th of 2005, in the initial application, the only identifying factor we have here is a 1995 law graduate as to whom the paralegal was or was not. And it wasn't until February 20th of 2007 that we had full disclosure that we're really talking about the paralegal being the same as the attorney. And that absence of definition in the initial application bothers me a great deal. I wonder if there's an explanation that you could provide on that.
I honestly cannot explain other than what was in the initial application was typical of what most people would have placed in it, that they were an attorney in the graduation and what their rate would or should have been. And in this particular case, you're quite correct, Your Honor, that it wasn't until later on that a full explanation was forthcoming. Although I believe it was discussed a little bit in the initial response to the Secretary's reply as well. But I don't have an adequate explanation.
I guess in most cost bills I see, you have cost of a firm or postage or something of that nature. And generally speaking, you reflect the fact that they are either unpaid or paid and provide evidence in affidavit or otherwise, reflecting to whom the money is owed or has been paid. And so that gives me a great deal of concern in this case.
Your Honor, if I could, on page 3 of the appellant's response to January 5th, she explained it at that particular time, the exact nature of the category of the task performed and so forth. That was clearly the first time that it was laid out.
That's a year and 1 month after the initial application. Okay, thank you.
If we were to follow the construct that you are proposing, which is either the attorney gets paid at perhaps a Laffey matrix rate for gray area or attorney tasks that they exercised a billing judgment and billed at a lower rate, or they get nothing because they didn't hire a paralegal to do these tasks. Is that the result that would happen, that if the court were to find that a task was truly a paralegal task, then the solo practitioner would be entitled to nothing for the time expended on those? Is that
that's how I read your one, yes. I mean, one could create a reasonable rate, but I'm not sure how that comports with Richland, which says it has to be at the actual cost of the attorney. And since there's no actual cost to the attorney,
well, in Richland, they actually didn't necessarily provide what the actual rate was to Richland's attorneys, in that the billing rate and purportedly, I guess, the payment rate of what they paid their paralegals would have varied over time. So they actually performed some sort of analysis to reach what would be a reasonable rate to be paid over the entire period of the litigation.
But in reading between the lines, and that's what I was doing, when they came up with a $35 figure, it was my understanding that that was approximately what the attorney's
sort of an average.
I think the difficulty here is that the Secretary obviously proposes that we use a rate that would be based upon what would cost the government.
Counsel, isn't there some consistency in a position that would say that if you contracted for paralegal services, it would cost you $35 an hour, and if you exercised your judgment as a sole practitioner and decided to do paralegal tasks, that all you ought to get for those is $35? Wouldn't that be consistent?
That would be consistent, except, again, I'm reading Richland in the sense that it's the actual cost, because it can't be part of the fee, according to the court. Richland, it has to be an actual cost. And again, the actual cost was never incurred because the attorney performed all the tasks in this particular situation. If I could just hit one more point. The overall fee application was also challenged in this case, and that was in the Secretary's initial response. It doesn't seem to me there to be any dispute about prevailing party net worth or substantial justification. I would note that there were 137.5 hours in this case that were not charged and that were reduced. Some of that was administrative time, some of that involved both paralegal rate, and I think the explanation in the original EJIA response by Ms. Goldberg outlines in detail why the time and effort was expended on this case, and that she should be entitled to the full fee, and there should be no reduction based upon that.
Speaking to the number of hours billed, when we broke down the number of hours billed as paralegal work, we came up with a different number than what Mr. Aponte's attorney claimed in the EJIA application. We came up with 16.1 rather than 14.6.
I came up with 16.1 as well. I looked at it, but she's only asking for 14.6.
Okay, I wanted to clarify that.
I might have missed.
Okay, thank you.